from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The fall semester is upon us. The students are back. College tuition checks are in, we hope. And President Obama says he has a new plan to make college affordable. Tie federal aid to college value, he says. Rank affordability and return on investment for every college and university. High tuition, low graduation rates. The president's plan looks to take federal aid away. That could be a motivator. This hour on Point, the president's push to lower the cost of college and reaction from the Ivory Tower. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Does this plan sound like a winner to you? Would you like to see rankings on value? Would you put a ranking system to use in your own college search? Will it hold down costs? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later this hour, we'll look at another part of the president's push on higher ed last week. He wants to cut law school from 3 years down to two. We'll get reaction. But first, on the big push, this was the president last Thursday at the University of Buffalo laying out his plan to rank colleges on value with an eye toward driving down costs. Here's the president.
We're going to start rating colleges, not just by which college is the most selective, not just by which college is the most expensive, not just by which college has the nicest facilities. You know, you can get all that in the existing rating systems. What we want to do is rate them on who's offering the best value so students and taxpayers get a bigger bang for their buck.
And why do all that? Here's the president again in Buffalo.
So whether we're talking about a two-year program, a four-year program, a technical certificate, bottom line is higher education cannot be a luxury. It's an economic imperative. Every American family should be able to afford to get it.
Let's go right to the source to look at the plan. Let's go to the White House. Joining me now from Washington is Roberto Rodriguez, Special Assistant to President Obama for Education Policy. He played a big part in putting together the new plan. Roberto Rodriguez, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tom. Good to join you.
So first of all, you're going to rank institutions of higher education on what vectors, Roberto?
Well, that's part of the president's plan that he discussed last week. His main message here is that higher education is still the best ticket to getting ahead in our economy today. And we have a real shared responsibility to do more to make sure that we keep it within reach of our middle-class families, that it's affordable for our middle-class families. So part of that plan is to make sure that we are doing more to do our part at the federal level to invest in federal aid. The president has invested over $60 billion in keeping college more affordable and boosting the Pell Grant and making our student loan programs more reliable and more effective. But he's also looking at this goal of doing more to create a new ranking system and looking at really sorting institutions based on important indicators related to access, to affordability, and ultimately to outcomes. We believe that it's important to really help our families understand the value that their higher education options have in front of them.
So I'm looking here at a summary of the elements that would be part of this ranking from a draft of the proposal, I guess, is in the Times, which says it would include this ranking, Roberto, would include tuition, graduation rates, debt, and earnings of graduates after they graduate, and the percentage of lower-income students who attend. Is that a pretty good summary of the elements that would go into this ranking?
That's right, and I think many of those elements, you know, that will have yet to be determined. What the president has called for is, over the course of the next 18 months, a process to really work in collaboration with experts, with higher education leaders, college leaders, state leaders, and others in the higher education community to really determine the type of system that would best function in terms of really measuring value and promoting quality.
But you've got an idea here that you're pushing out there.
We do.
So help us understand. Your idea is that the top-ranked school here would have, I guess in the ideal, the lowest tuition, the highest graduation rate, the least debt for its alums, and they'd have the biggest paychecks.
Well, these are important. Those are some of the important indicators that actually are part of a current tool that our administration put forth after the President's State of the Union address earlier this year. That's the College Scorecard, and that was introduced in January. It provides information on every institution of higher education around the real price, the cost for students, the graduation rates, default rates, the typical borrowing yep. of students. So those we want to build on this College Scorecard and also look at other indicators around outcomes and around quality and with a particular focus on our disadvantaged students.
Sure.
We know that part of getting ahead in the economy and part of meeting the president's charge to us to lead the world with the highest proportion of college graduates by 2020 requires us to do better in terms of bridging this college attainment gap that we have between our low-income students and their more affluent peers.
So, I mean, that's important to me. I never could have gone to the college I did without somebody paying a lot of attention to bringing in lower-income students.
Right.
So people understand that.
Right.
But you've also got a stick in here, Roberto, that for those who don't rank well, you would pull back on federal aid. How?
Well, the president's plan here is to, over the next 18 months, as I said, develop the system, and then we will work with Congress to determine how that system and that ranking might be used to leverage the over $130 billion in taxpayer dollars that we invest in college aid.
Yeah, but you've got some ideas about how. So what? Like what?
Right. Well, we would look at what we can do around the Pell Grant and other grant aid to support students at institutions that deliver a high value and high quality.
So if you've got a gold-plated school, high cost, that's not delivering value, you would withdraw Pell Grants for students interested in that school? Is that the idea?
No. Well, some of the details there, Tom, have yet to be determined. We want to really work with Congress once we actually have this ranking system
up
and running.
I know, but don't get too fuzzy
exactly
with us.
How we can do this.
I get it, but you've got an idea, and we want to understand it. You're going down to Congress
right.
with an idea. The president was talking about it last week, so please don't
right.
get too
well,
fuzzy with us.
So
we're trying to weigh this.
The president didn't determine discuss the specific details around how the federal student aid would be leveraged. I think he really does want to work with Congress to determine how best to do that.
Sure.
I think it would be looking at the student aid programs and grant programs that we currently have available and driving a greater share of that aid, ultimately, to institutions that are higher performing with respect to affordability, value, and quality.
Do you think that will get do you think that'll get college's attention? Is that enough of a crowbar, enough leverage?
We do. We believe it's an important part of this shared responsibility that we have to keep colleges affordable. And, you know, part of the other message that the president delivered last week is that states have a role here as well. We want to encourage states to do more to deliver their over $70 billion in aid that they deliver to their public colleges and universities based on performance.
I mean,
we know over 30 states already are experimenting with this type of approach to look at rewarding those institutions that actually help their students complete and persist through to earn their degree.
But at the state level, you know, states have been cutting back massively on their support to state schools. That's the number one thing that's been driving tuition up at state
that's
schools.
Absolutely right.
So would
now.
You then come in as the federal government and punish those schools on top of the state aid they've already lost? You'd take away Pell Grant aid?
Well, here the president has proposed a carrot. We actually have a $1 billion proposal called the Race to the Top for Higher Education that would support states that are really leading the pack with respect to their investments in higher education. There's no doubt that the diminishing investment in higher ed at the state level has had a direct impact on higher tuitions and higher costs for families.
Would your plan close some schools down, Mr. Rodriguez? You know, you'd pull out some of that federal aid, and it's not easy for colleges sometimes to hold it all together anyway. We talk about them as gold-plated, but it's not always a cushy business. Would it close some down, and would you welcome that if they're not delivering?
So the plan isn't designed specifically to close down institutions. It is designed really to recalibrate our higher education system to focus more on affordability and ultimately to reward those institutions that deliver greater affordability and greater value for their students.
Do you think you can actually
federal investment?
Do you think it's enough to actually deliver on that? You know, there'll be a lot of resistance. Can you really bring down the cost of college relative to Americans' incomes?
Well, I'll say certainly there's no silver bullet here. And the rating system that the president discussed last week is one part of a comprehensive plan. Mm-hmm. They're also, we're not going to get there if we also don't harness innovation in new ways and really change the way that we're delivering teaching and learning at our institutions of higher education today. Part of the president's call for innovation there is to look at how, ways to use technology to redesign courses. We can save 40 to 70% in costs if we redesign some of these entry-level courses using technology and a greater focus on personalizing learning, for instance, in key subjects like math and science.
Are you talking about online lectures, that sort of thing?
And blended use of technology, Tom, to really bring in tutors and bring in other types of adaptive technologies that still utilize an instructor in the classroom, but also really keep pace with students and adapt to where they are with the content.
We've just got you for 20 more seconds. You're there at the drafting table on this. So what's your spreadsheet tell you? What's your hope? What percentage, by what percentage do you hope to bring down college costs or rein them in?
We're very confident that part of the president's message last week was to jumpstart a conversation nationally around affordability, and this is a shared responsibility. We believe we can do a lot here at the federal level with some of the reforms he's talked about in terms of driving innovation, rewarding our states that are leading the charge here, and doing more to really prioritize value and affordability in rankings.
Yeah.
And we believe that states have an important role here to play as well. And
Mr. Rodriguez, we're out of time. We're grateful to you for being with us. Special Assistant to the President for Education Policy, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back on the issue. Talking this hour about President Obama's cost-cutting push to rank American colleges by best value and cut federal aid to those who don't deliver, a White House push to try to drive the cost of college down. Here was the president once more last Thursday, University of Buffalo.
We're going to deliver on a promise we made last year, which is colleges that keep their tuition down and are providing high-quality education are the ones that are going to see their taxpayer funding go up. It is time to stop subsidizing schools that are not producing good results and reward schools that deliver for American students in our future.
All right, let's dive in on this. With us right now from New York is Judith Scott Clayton. She is Assistant Professor of Economics and Education at Columbia University's Teachers College. She's also Senior Research Associate at the Community College Research Center. Judith Scott Clayton, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Your first response to the president's broadly outlined proposal?
Well, it's certainly ambitious, and as somebody who studies higher education, that's exciting. A lot of people were thinking that they would just kind of tweak around the edges, do some small things that the president could do without having to go to Congress. And it's hard to think of what he could do without going to Congress. So it's exciting that they're thinking big. And I think they are right that structural changes are needed. We can't just continue on having this conversation about how big are our Pell Grants, how big are the tax credits, how much are we going to subsidize student loans. We need to do something different.
So what's most ambitious about this plan, Judith?
Well, the ambitious part is the part that you were already talking about, which is linking federal student aid to rankings of institutional performance. And unfortunately, while there are some good aspects of the broader proposal, some of the other ideas that are in there, and while the intentions, I think, are good behind this idea, the idea itself, as I think we heard, is a little bit half-baked. The details aren't all there yet, and I think they know that. That's why they pushed off until 2018, the date that this would go into effect.
Mm-hmm.
But the details are really important. And what details are there in the plan that people have seen are worrisome.
Well, could we stick – before we get to the details, let's stick with the big outline of what they're proposing. And, you know, rank schools on tuition. The lower the better. Graduation rates, the higher the better. Debt, the lower the better. Earnings, the higher the better. And – you know, how many lower-income students get in there? We've got a lot of lower-income people in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And then turn around, and if they, for those who don't succeed, whack them with lower federal student support. That basic formula, what do you think of that, Judith?
Well, we might separate out the question of what rankings should look like, what things should go in there. That's a pretty complicated question in itself. But separate that out from, say that we had the perfect rating or ranking system that everybody could kind of agree had the right things in it and they were adjusted appropriately. Then there's still the question of what do you want to do with that information? And I think the part where this proposal really goes out on a limb is suggesting that we should link Pell Grants and perhaps student loan access to these federal rankings.
But that's the stick. You say that's the crowbar here.
That's right.
So, are you just saying I'm in academia, so I don't want a crowbar around? Nobody likes crowbars when it's there. Don't we need something that would really get people's attention? This is not easy work, presumably, to break down costs.
It's just the details are so important, and you could really mess – it's pretty easy to mess up the details. So if you're messing up the details as far as what goes in these rankings, but you're messing it up on kind of a small amount of funding, then the stakes are lower. And it's possible – it is possible to use a smaller fund, maybe some carrots instead of some sticks that would get people's attention, get institutions' attention, focused on some of these priorities without penalizing students who happen to be at institutions that raise their tuition. So you can imagine if we just imagine that the ratings themselves are perfect, and let's think about a couple of cases how this might work. So imagine that there's a case of a really high-performing community college that has a great rating, and there is another college, a for-profit college that's nearby that has a really horrible rating. So we're thinking that this is going to – we're going to give the students at the community college a big Pell Grant, and the one that chooses the for-profit is going to get a small Pell Grant. And we're hoping that that's going to affect their choice. All of this – this proposal, the mechanism is it's working through the student's choice. If the student doesn't know about the Pell Grant before they enroll and they don't know that they're going to get something different if they go to one school versus the other, it's not going to work. And the fact is in this specific example, the students already have a huge financial incentive to attend a community college instead of a for-profit. If they attend the community college, they'll probably get money back from their Pell Grant. It will more than cover their tuition. Whereas at the for-profit, they're going to have to take out loans. So the question is, why are students making that choice now? And would changing their incentive a little bit on the margin be enough to override all the other factors that are leading students to make that decision, which might have to do with marketing and so on?
Right. Let's look at these ranking factors for a second. What do you make of ranking schools on the basis of tuition? Lower the better. The lower your tuition, the higher your ranking.
I think the idea that students need more information about how much schools cost and how much they personally will pay to attend different institutions is really important. I think students are totally confused about it, and the existing college scorecard tries to help out with that. But the idea that a student who goes to a public institution, and most students go to public institutions in state, that they are going along to their public institution, and then the state 1 year cuts back funding to that institution, so they have to raise tuition prices. That the
Which
student
has happened a lot.
Then gets right, and that the student would then get kind of kicked on the other end by the federal government and get a smaller Pell Grant. I just the logic that underpins that doesn't make sense.
Graduation rates, so ranking on graduation rates sounds like to a lot of people that must sound good. What do you think?
Again, I think this is. This is something that students need to know, that schools do have different graduation rates. Just that basic piece of information is not always available to students when they're making their decision. They don't know where to find it. But it needs to be somehow adjusted for the fact that schools serve very different populations. So it might not be that helpful to a student to know that their community college might have a 30% graduation rate. And Harvard has a 90% graduation rate.
Because that community college may take on a lot of tough cases.
That's right. And they also serve many other different missions besides just, producing graduates. They transfer students to four-year institutions. So it needs to somehow be adjusted for what the institution's mission is and what kind of population it's serving.
What about earnings? The earnings of graduates of a school as an integral part of its ranking in this setup?
Again, I think more information in this area is a good thing. A lot of institutions themselves would love to have that information on their graduates or on their non-graduates, what percentage are finding jobs within a certain amount of time and what they're earning. And the federal government is in a good position to provide that sort of information.
Because how would they do that? Follow the Social Security numbers? Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, potentially they could get it from income tax data or from the Social Security Administration. And they could do a much better job of getting a good estimate of how graduates are doing.
Do colleges want to be rated on that? Or are they going to say, look, our job is to give an education. We're not a job training center.
Right, right. So there's certainly a concern that people just focus on the things that we can measure, and earnings are something that we can measure. I do think it's a relevant measure. It's not the only measure. And certainly schools that are training a lot of teachers or a lot of students who go into public service may not do as well on that measure. So I would like to see if they go in that direction, potentially looking at some other outcomes of graduates, such as the percent that are going into the public sector, or the percent that are going into teaching, that would provide a little bit of a counterweight to those earnings metrics. But I do think it is a valid one valid way of looking at the success of graduates. The other concern there is, again, because not everybody graduates, you have to be careful about only looking at the earnings of graduates.
Right, sure.
You could have a school that only graduates 10%, and those 10% do very, very well.
Right. Judith, stand by. Bob Hildreth joins us in a moment. We have so many callers. I want to get a couple in right here, if I may. Elizabeth is calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Hi, Elizabeth. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Well, what's your experience?
Parent of a boy who is a senior in high school. We're looking at 4-year college, and I just want to say the scorecard is beautiful. Any parent, any student, and even community members should go online and Google College Navigator, and I found it.
Is this the federal scorecard that's out there already, Elizabeth, you're saying?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
It's extensive. I throw the glossy brochures away and just look at College Navigator because it gives me so much information. Including, if you're wondering how many do they graduate, it tells you what percentage of the freshmen graduate within 6 years. And I'm finding some really unsettling numbers at state universities in my state. Mm. The larger flagships are solid, but these small, really small,
right.
6 out of 10 crash and burn. And when I have friends who are considering sending their children to these institutions, I direct them to College Navigator. And
So get the information out there, and parents like you will pay close attention. What about your high school senior son? Does he want to judge on the basis of this kind of indicator or, you know, on the basis of prestige, big name? I don't know, Elizabeth.
I think he has an idea of where he wants to go based on gosh knows where he gets his ideas. I don't know. but I know... You know, we're going to be paying some bucks, and we have a say. And where he wants to go is a solid institution. But I know there are some other kids who, for whatever reason, are considering these really small. They are 4-year, but they are. I think
we hear it. The numbers don't look good to you, and you got the heads up from exactly this kind of survey, the College Navigator, this federal scorecard in that case. Elizabeth, I appreciate your call very much. Thanks for calling in. I want to bring Bob Hildreth into our conversation with me in the studio, founder and chairman of Fuel Education. It's a nonprofit that helps families prepare for the cost of college. Bob Hildreth, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
What do you make of the president's plan? Broad as it may be, we get the idea. Rank and prepare to punish or reward.
Clearly, it's one more step that the government is taking to put pressure on colleges. I would also note his State of the Union address.
Yeah.
But I believe that it's largely a distraction from what really causes the increase in tuition. And that's what the 500% increase in tuition over the last 10 years is the thing that threatens to break the back of colleges.
500% where? Private schools? State school? Public schools? What?
It's the combination.
Wow. So what's the heart of the matter to your eye, Bob?
The heart of the matter is the connection between the government and colleges. The government gives $1 trillion in aid.
Yeah.
Now, that $1 trillion isn't going to students. All of it is going to colleges. It goes to colleges in a wire transfer every September and January.
It's a Pell Grant. The students get the grant, but you're saying it flows right to the institution.
Right. None of that money touches the students.
Yeah, home. Well.
And it becomes a guarantee that the colleges know they're going to get every year. So a $1 trillion aid that really only started in the 1990s is more than the Marshall Plan.
So you're saying this has fueled the run-up in tuition costs.
Yes. What has happened is that the colleges, it's too much of a good thing. So colleges have become dependent on this flow.
But here we are. How do you cut it back or cut it down without hurting both the students and colleges?
I think that the best way to cut it down is to make the system transparent. What you would do is you would have the colleges, not the government, lend the money to the students.
Federal money, but lent through the college?
Correct.
But what about this as a midway point there? The president's trying to use the leverage of that huge flow of money you're pointing to bring college costs down. I mean, isn't the... I mean,
too
he's
late.
Trying to use it.
Yeah.
What do you mean too late? He's going to rank them and take it away, in effect, from those who don't do well on the rankings.
It's too late because state colleges, public school colleges, are already over 50%. They get over 50% of their tuition income from the government. The private figure is over 31%. So now the relation of dependency is so strong that unless we attack that precisely— nothing will be done.
But isn't that also federal leverage? Isn't that what they're flexing here or talking about flexing?
Absolutely. Unfortunately, leverage means sticks and carrots.
Yeah.
And the ranking system is all that the president can do. Putting in sticks and carrots also require the government.
Yeah.
But a much more simple system is to say, you know that $130 billion we're going to give you in 2014? Mm-hmm. Well, guess what? It's $110. It's $110 billion.
So you say lend it through the school, then they would have an interest. They would line up the incentives. They'd want their students to graduate. They'd want them to do well. It would be a kind of organic relationship. Andrew's calling from Fort Benning, Georgia. Andrew, you're on the air. Hello, Andrew. Are you there, my friend? Oh, Andrew, sounds like you may be having a walk. Anne in Concord, Massachusetts. Anne, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have a question. Well, I have two young children right now. Mm-hmm. My husband and I were both really hoping that higher education will be reformed over the next decade so we'll be able to afford to send our children. So I applaud any efforts to look at this value. My question goes back to the outcome measures beyond looking just at employability and graduation rates. And this pertains to a show you did recently. What about, you know, analytic ability and, overall growth of the student, things that are less measurable or quantifiable? Is this part of the metric system at all? Or
Let us pick that up. And Judith, I'll bring that to you, a listener online here as well. Brian says, I didn't realize that the only purpose of college was to prepare you for your first job. If earnings are a big part of the way we're ranking here, and it's true that I don't see, I mean, it's harder to rank insight or measure it, but I see tuition, graduation rates, debt, earnings. What about that more ineffable part of the deepest part of learning, Judith?
Yes, it's kind of like the quest for the Holy Grail. We would love to have some way of getting a good measure of student learning at the end of college. Even if we could figure out how to define it, if we could all agree on how to define it, the problem is it's just very, very difficult to measure in practice. And I think that's why you don't see it in this plan.
Are you afraid this plan would turn institutions of higher education into trade schools?
No, I think if they put some other counterweights in there, like looking at other outcomes besides earnings, such as percent of students going into the public sector, percent of students going into teaching, that would provide at least some counterweight. But there's going to always need to be quite a deal of interpretation that goes along with any ratings,
Judith,
any
measure. Judith, stand by. We've got a break right here. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about President Obama's cost-cutting push to rank American colleges by best value and cut federal aid to those who don't deliver. It's part of a White House push to try to drive the cost of college down. Of course, he can rank them on his own. Putting the stick in there, that would require congressional cooperation. We'll see how that might go. Judith Scott Clayton is with us from Columbia University's Teacher College. She's also a senior research associate at the Community College Research Center. And with me in the studio is Bob Hildreth. He's founder and chairman of Fuel Education. It's a nonprofit that works to help get low-income kids into college and pay for it. Judith, Bob, lots of response online here. Hillary says, far too many holes in this plan. She says, I believe Texas started state funding in a similar way, and what happened is that professors feel compelled to pass students who otherwise would have flunked to keep their graduation rates up, maybe. I don't know. Yes, you can get all kinds of unintended consequences. Skepticism aplenty out there. Robert writes, universities are finally hitting the wall of extracting the maximum price they can from the belief that an education has no real limit to its value. They're racketeers. It's a rigged game. Stephen writes, it doesn't address the problem of college bloat, dorms too fancy, you know, needless, too many big name professors. There's a lot of skepticism out there. Bob, do you have a sense from working with families that they have confidence that there's somebody, anybody watching out for on this cost of college front?
I think that they don't. But on their own, they're showing an ability to pivot from prestige to value. In our program 4 years ago, we had people going to all of the private, well-known colleges. Right now, we have 20 kids at Salem State. They understand the value, and they understand they have to keep debt down.
And they're eager to do that. I mean, Judith, do you see anything apart from the president's plan that leans toward the same kind of result? Bob says people are pivoting from prestige to value. Are people doing this on their own?
Well, I think it is worth noting that it's true that many states, several states, have gone in a similar direction. Maybe that's where this president's proposal is coming from, some of the states that have instituted their own performance funding systems. But there are a couple of reasons to be concerned that what's going on at the state level may not necessarily transfer well to the federal level. First, the states that have experimented with this have generally only used a relatively small proportion of funds at stake, maybe 5% or so. And I'm not aware of any state which has talked about linking institutional performance to individual student aid, which is what the president's plan appears to be proposing to do. The other thing about doing this at the state level is it's a much narrower context. It's only one state. In most cases, they're only talking about the funds that are going to public institutions, whereas the president's plan would be nationwide and would apply across different sectors. And as one of the callers, I guess, has noted, not every one of these state performance plans has gone well. Some of them have had unintended consequences, and some of them have gone away because of that. And it's still very much an experimentation process at the state level, and it's not clear that we have learned all the lessons that we need to learn from those experiments.
I want to go to Chris in New Orleans. Chris, thanks for calling. You're on the air. What do you see?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to ask the panelists, what do they think about the disproportionate effect that it might have, this proposal might have, on small liberal arts schools that don't specialize in STEM technologies? Because STEM fields have a tendency to have higher salaries. So I just wanted to know what they thought, how that might kind of influence students' majors, and that's something that's desirable.
Good question. I appreciate it, Chris. Judith, I'll put that one to you.
That brings up another issue, which is if we're trying to measure the earnings of graduates, when are we going to measure them? In most cases, places that have tried to do this, they're only able to look out a year or two at what students are doing. And so what you find if you only look out a year or two is that certain career paths, they're not at their peak payoff in that year or two afterwards. And in fact, some of the liberal arts degrees may require further graduate training or just kind of have a stepping stone where you start off in one job and then you continue to move up along your career, it's a different trajectory than a student who goes into a very kind of narrow career field where they just jump right back into the labor force. And they may have higher earnings initially, but they kind of plateau.
So it could be tougher on the smaller liberal arts school that Chris is asking
about.
Yeah,
I think that is a concern. When you see comparisons of earnings of students in liberal arts fields versus technical fields, one concern that I have with those data is that they're just looking too soon after somebody has graduated. Yeah. And you really need to wait 10 or 15 or 20 years to know how these two different trajectories are paying off. And that's just not practical. We can't have an accountability system that is
that
going to be lagged. Right.
That long. So a good and fair question, Chris. And I guess Judith shares your concern on that front. Tim in Spring Green, Wisconsin. Tim, you're on.
Hi, Tom. You know, I was just nervous about quantifying the educational experience, and I had two quick points. One of them was tuition costs. It can vary so much. You get what you pay for in a lot of places. Large flagship schools have faculty that is extremely highly regarded in their field, and of course that's going to cost more, and I think it's hard to figure out, you know, what effect does that have on tuition, and is it worth it? And then the other one is looking at community colleges. I went to one myself for a while, and used it the way a lot of people do, which is training programs. How does that affect? It's not you didn't graduate, but you received training in a specific field, and then you went on to other things. And I wonder how that factors in.
Good questions, Tim. Bob, how about this issue? Tim says, you know, some colleges have reasons for being expensive. Big name, high talent faculty, you name it. How's that factor into this?
Surely, you have very different faculties across the country. But overall, all of these colleges have been fed so much money from the government that everyone has bloat. One of the big areas connects with healthcare. Healthcare at large institutions of learning is very expensive.
I mean, their own healthcare costs for their staff and faculty.
Probably one of the first or second reasons why it's going up. Nonetheless, they're easily able to cover that by the transfers coming in from Department of Education. I want to just mention one thing. That this program that the president is suggesting actually has been tried. 3 years ago, the Congress, angry at for-profit schools, decided that they would penalize any school which had default rates on student loans that were exceedingly high. Mm-hmm. They placed the bar very high in order to catch online schools but not affect traditional schools. So guess what the online schools did? They saw who their kids were who were defaulting, and they made sure that they were in deferral programs. So It's a very difficult thing to police.
Systems can be played. The president stepping in here trying to find a way. It's going to be fascinating to see when the rubber starts to meet the road how the big spokespeople for academia come to the table, what they have to say to their congressmen and ultimately to the federal government. Bob Hildreth with Fuel Education, it's been great having you with us for your insights today. Thank you so much for joining us. And Judith Scott Clayton at Columbia University's Teachers College in New York. Judith, many thanks to you as well for joining us today.
Thank you.
In a moment, we'll look at the president's suggestion to cut law school from 3 years down to two. This is On Point. On On Friday, President Obama spoke at Binghamton University as part of his college affordability tour. Among a lot of other things, he said law schools would be wise to shift students to a 2-year degree program instead of the traditional 3. That comment from the president has got a lot of attention. Here's a little bit from the town hall meeting at Binghamton University where the president spoke.
I believe, for example, that law schools would probably be wise to think about being 2 years into 3 years. Because by the third year, in the first 2 years, young people are learning in the classroom. The third year, they'd be better off clerking or practicing in a firm, even if they weren't getting paid that much. But that step alone would reduce the cost for the student.
The president, of course, himself a law school graduate, knows something of what he speaks. But you can imagine this setting off waves. Joining us now from New York is Jennifer Smith, Wall Street Journal reporter, covers law firms and corporate law. She recently wrote an article headlined, Legal Education on Trial. Is the third year necessary? Jennifer, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me, Tom.
So is this a proposal that's already got currency in the law school world, or was the president's comment a kind of little quake?
Well, it's not surprising that this might be on his mind, given that the president was himself a law professor for a number of years at University of Chicago. It's a debate that's been has sort of ebbed and flowed in the legal academy for a number of decades now, and it's sort of coming to a head again as law students are there's a couple of different factors, but law students are finding it very hard to get jobs right now because of contractions in the market. At the same time, student debt levels are really high, and the tuition at law schools continues to climb.
So going to a 2-year program would, I guess, presumably make it less expensive. Graduates would come out with their degree, but not so much debt.
That's the idea. And, of course, the president seemed to be sort of sketching out the outlines of something. It's unclear if after those 2 years the kind of apprenticeship model that he discussed would involve, you know, some sort of training wheels linked to the school or what have you. But at the base of it, it's a question of math. Less year of school, less year of tuition.
Are law schools prepared to cut their price, in effect, for a law degree by a third if they would cut a year off of the program?
Well, that seems unlikely. Right now, they're facing declining enrollment anyway. Enrollment in law schools really surged during the recession. I think a lot of folks were taking refuge from the economy there, but it's really dipped down quite dramatically in the last year or so. So, I imagine law school deans would probably be loath to give up, you know, another one-third of their revenue. That said, there are some schools that do offer compressed programs that take 2 years to complete, but they often charge the same sort of dollar per tuition credit as a 3-year course. So you're not really getting a big savings aside from what you would spend on room and board for the time that you're out of the workforce.
I mean, I wonder what lawyers and law schools think about this in any case. I'm looking at headlines here saying America has way too many lawyers and the bubble is growing. If you cut the course down to 2 years, presumably that would attract in some additional margin of attendees.
That's an excellent point, and it's one that one prominent critic of legal education, Brian Tamanaha, had made when I spoke with him about this. While he certainly said, you know, we should reconsider the third year and whether it's really worth the price, if you lower, there are already sort of a glut of law graduates right now compared with jobs available. So if you lower the bar for entry, would you simply be churning out more lawyers into a market where there's really not that many opportunities for them to find paying work and, of course, to help pay off some of that staggering loan debt that many have?
Have you seen unemployment rates for law school grads, recent ones at this point, Jennifer? Does anybody break that out?
I couldn't speak to unemployment rates that so far. I don't have the figures in front of me, but it's pretty tough. The I'm trying to remember what they are. I think that, you know, for the first year out of law school, it's pretty challenging for folks to get a job. If you look at schools in aggregate, the other thing that plays into this debate, however, is it sort of depends on where you go to law school. So some of the most elite law schools, they might be placing 90% of their students have a job a year after graduation and only 10% don't, whereas the ratio might be far different at a school that's lower down in the rankings or not in a key job market. So there's a prestige question, too. So not all students are being hit the same.
Could you explain something about the content of a law school education? I mean, explain how you might just lop off a full year of a three-year education and still consider it just fine. Does that mean that third year there's nothing going on? Or what happened in that third year now if the president thinks it's expendable?
Well, I admit it sounds dramatic, although, mind you, the three-year model has been, that's been the sort of primary model for law school for about a century.
So what's going on in that third year?
So the first couple years, you're learning sort of the basics, you know, you're learning about torts, you're learning sort of different, you're sort of mastering sort of legal fundamentals and what they like to call thinking like a lawyer. So there's sort of a Socratic method of discussion mm-hmm. in the classrooms. And the third year, students often spend time on various electives. Now, these could be something like specializing more closely in patent law or business law, but there have also there's some elective courses that have been, you know, lampooned, such as the law and wine. There's sort of a wide variety of them, but there's increasingly a greater emphasis on clinical courses, so law clinics, externships. Having a third mm-hmm. year where students are out in the world to some degree practicing law, picking up practical skills, but under the supervision to some degree of the law school, which is why they're still paying tuition. That's been an answer to a question that some are raising, whether lawyers are prepared.
Who is ultimately going to decide this? I mean, the president can't just snap his fingers and make it so. Where would this be hashed out, moving to from 3 to 2 years? And whatever that institution or those powers may be, do you think they're ultimately inclined, Jennifer?
I think a number of hurdles stand in the way. So the primary deciders on this are the American Bar Association, which is the sort of national industry group
yep.
for lawyers. They accredit most U.S. law schools, and they have a council that sort of decides which schools get accredited, and they're the ones who sort of set the number of credit hours, basically what you need to master in order to earn a JD.
Mm-hmm.
But they make these decisions sort of in concert with lawyers in the field and with judges who are on the council, as well as all the different states. When you sit for the state bar, they're groups, usually state courts, bar groups, make decisions about what level of preparation you need before you can sit to take the exam to earn your law license.
So if you were my bookie, what do you think the odds are of the United States going to a two-year law degree anytime in the next, I don't know, decade?
In the next decade, you know, it's gained a little bit of steam.
Hmm,
I might have said slim to anorexic earlier, but, you know, there may be at least more flexibility on that third year coming up, given, you know, that voices as prominent as President Obama's have been
right out there on it. Jennifer Smith with The Wall Street Journal, thank you so much for being with us. Thanks for joining us, listeners. This is On Point.